I'm Katie Clark, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Across the globe, there's often a tension between preserving land and preserving culture. Environmental groups and governments have set aside vast areas of parkland, but in an effort to protect native ecosystems, they've sometimes evicted native peoples. Writer Mark Dowie harshly criticizes that practice in his latest book. It's called Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. Dowie writes that more than 12% of the land worldwide is now under conservation protection. That's an area larger than the continent of Africa.
In the course of protecting that land, millions of people have been displaced from the land in the putative interest of conservation. People who have been living in, for the most part, have been living on those lands for hundreds or thousands of years, clearly living sustainably, or the conservation establishment wouldn't be interested in preserving the land. And it's turned out to be a mistake. And I think, you know, the conservation movement now realizes that it's a mistake and are going to pretty impressive ends to rectify it.
Give us an example of how conservation has negatively affected the people who live on the land. And I was thinking maybe about the Batwa or pygmies.
Yeah, the Batwa in Uganda, the Batwa pygmies, who were in 1993 evicted from the Bwindi impenetrable forest where they had been living for thousands of years, clearly sustainably. That's a very, very healthy forest. They actually, after the area, the Bwindi, was gazetted, they were allowed to stay for quite a while. And it was a rumor that was spread, furthered by Diane Fossey, that the pygmy were killing the great apes, which they weren't. And that's what led to their eviction. And they now live on the perimeter of the Bwindi in rundown, squalorous villages, and have had their entire livelihood and their culture taken from them.
Are they allowed back at all to their native lands?
Yes, they can get permits to go in and harvest honey. They can get permits to go in and visit their ancestors' graves. They're scattered through the Bwindi. But the Bwindi is guarded now by eco-guards, armed eco-guards, who, if they believe that somebody is poaching inside the forest, they'll shoot them.
I don't want to ignore what's happened here in the United States, where when it comes to land conservation, we've had our stories of not treating Native people so well either. And I'm just thinking we're talking on the heels of the Ken Burns TV documentary on the national parks, where Burns hit on that tension between preservation and use, but didn't actually come down on one side of the issue or the other. Talk a little bit about what happened in this country.
He does acknowledge that Native people have been evicted from American national parks. This whole model of conservation began here in Yosemite in the middle of the 19th century, which was at the time occupied by Miwok Indians. And John Muir and the other people who were inspired to create a national park where Yosemite is were not impressed with the Indians. In fact, Muir was revolted by them and asked that they be removed from the park, and they were. And that happened again in Yellowstone and several other American parks around the country. That became known as the Yosemite model of conservation and was exported by the organizations that now dominate global conservation, all of which are American organizations.
You describe your book as a good guy versus good guy story. So is there anybody in particular to blame for how this seemingly good idea has gone wrong?
It is a good guy versus good guy story. I mean, you've got to say that people who are trying to preserve biological diversity and endangered species around the world are, you know, on a good mission. However, I think it's a misperception on the part of the early leaders of global conservation that Native people were not good stewards of the land, which was based on their lack of textbook science, really, and a disrespect for their traditional ecological knowledge, which they'd accumulated over thousands of years, largely driven, of course, by food security, not by conservation.
Explain a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Well, if you're living in an area and you're relying on what that area delivers to you in the way of sustenance, your primary motivation for protecting the natural health of that area is food security. It's not some romantic notion about wilderness, or it's not a tourist industry. It is food security. That's the primary motive.
You want to make sure you're going to have food for your family and for your children's children, that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly. And strangely enough, if a culture operates that way in an ecosystem, it seems to be pretty good for the ecosystem.
So how do you propose we strike a better balance between what's good for the land and what's good for the people who lived there?
Well, first of all, let the people who live there stay there when you create a protected area. In Canada, there's been recently been two interesting developments, one in British Columbia where Native people have been allowed to return to a national park, and then another in Quebec where a national park has been formed on Cree land, and the Crees are going to stay there, continue their life ways, and manage the park. I think that's the future of national parks and the future of protected areas. Involve the local people in the conservation project and the management of it, and respect the traditional ecological knowledge that they've developed, which has kept the place as healthy as it is.
Are there any examples of places that are getting conservation right from the get-go?
One place I think where the future of conservation is going to be severely tested is in Gabon. The reason I say that is because the country very suddenly created 13 national parks recently, all in areas that could easily have become forest concessions or mining concessions, all of which are occupied by indigenous people. So here is a test case now for a nation backed by the United States government, which put $56 million into this park system, and supported by the Wildlife Conservation Society and three other big international conservation groups, to do it right. I mean, to go in there and start negotiating right away, do what they're doing in Canada with the Cree, and let the native people stay there and be part of the management and protection of these areas.
Mark, we've been talking about the native peoples of these lands that have been created into parks and how they've been kicked off that land and haven't really done so well. Are there examples of these people who are gone now as a result of what's happened?
I would say not entirely gone, but I would say that the Basarwa, the Bushmen of the Kalahari, their culture is seriously threatened by the fact that they have been removed and put into basically what amount to concentration camps. The Maasai, who for thousands of years cultivated and ranged their cattle in the Rift Valley, they've been seriously decimated as a culture. And I visited the Batwa, and it was very sad to see how rapidly they are losing their song, their dance, and their indigenous culture. Land is part of culture. Culture shapes place, and place shapes culture. And if you remove people from the place where their culture evolved, they're going to lose that culture. And it happens in, like, less than a generation.
Writer Mark Dowie's book is called Conservation Refugees, the 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. Mark, good to speak with you. Thanks.
Thanks, Katie.